Hello and greetings to all of you in the name of Jesus. I want to remind you today that Jesus is alive and that he is reigning right at this very moment. I invite you to open your Bibles again to the book of James, James chapter 1. I don't suppose that James had any idea when he was writing this letter to his brothers and sisters who were scattered in various places and were experiencing trials that almost 2,000 years later, brothers and sisters who are still scattered abroad and who are still experiencing various kinds of trials would be reading this letter and also receiving encouragement from this. I have the strong sense as I read the letter of James that it is written from a heart of love, a heart of concern, a heart of care for the people of God. Today, for context's sake, we'll be reading verses 12 through 16 of James 1. Follow with me as I read. Blessed is the man who endures temptation, for when he has been approved, he will receive the crown of life which the Lord has promised to those who love him. Let no one say when he is tempted, I am tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he himself tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires and enticed. Then when desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is full grown, brings forth death. Do not be deceived, my beloved brethren. Now when we ended last Sunday, we ended in verse 12. And it was like we were watching a mountain climber ascend to the summit that verse 12 is. It's though James has shown us this man ascending through the temptations and proving himself and being faithful and at the last receiving the crown of life which the Lord has promised to all who love him. Now in verse 13 and following, it seems as though James is taking us a little closer to this mountain climber and showing us the dangerous chasms on either side of his narrow path that he is on. The situation that he finds himself is one that he must be completely focused in. James is, as it were, putting stakes in the ground alongside this narrow way, warning the climber, and these signs are here today for our benefit as well. Watch out, be careful, mind yourself. So verse 13 is the scope of our message today. Verse 13 contains one of those signs. When we read the Bible, we will often see two themes that reoccur. We learn, number one, about man and who he is. And as we read the Bible, we can often see our own selves in the words and actions and attitudes of people who we are reading about. The other thing, and more importantly, as we read the Bible, we can see God. And we see the theme of God and who he is. And indeed, it should be that way, for it is the intention of the author of this book that we learn more about him and his character and his nature and his ways as we read this book. So here in verse 13, we see both things. We see man and who he is, his tendency. And we see God and who he is and his character. So there's four things, two each for man and God, that I see in verse 13. The first one is man is tempted. The second thing is that man is inclined to blame others. And then about God, we see that God cannot be tempted by evil. And then James also teaches us that God never, ever tempts people to do evil. So these are some things that we can learn from this one verse. And these are the four things that I want to highlight in the time that we have this morning for the message. And I'm titling the message today, Trusting in the Untemptable God. Trusting in the Untemptable God. Let's look first at the first thing that I mentioned, and that is that man is tempted. Now, I had told you last time and before that the words trial and temptations are used interchangeably in James here. He uses them to mean one and the same. Some other words could be difficulties or challenges or contests. So here in verse 13, we see the word, it's the verb form of temptation used frequently, don't we? But I think we also see kind of a sinister change in the way that James is using this word tempt or tempted. I believe here James is talking about a temptation that is an invitation, a solicitation to sin, to go against what one knows is to be right and to do the wrong thing. And so the words, like I said, trial and temptation, as we understand the word, often go together. The trials that we have are often the seedbed or the opportunity or the chance for a temptation to occur. And James will well illustrate some of the temptations that these brothers were facing and that they were giving into during their hours of trial that they were experiencing. We'll see how James addresses the temptation for them to use swift and hasty and angry words and to use their tongue in negative ways. We'll see later in chapter 2 how during this time of trial and testing, they were also being tempted to be prejudiced against brothers who were of lesser status in their minds. And another theme we see in James is the sheer selfishness of people who were being tested, and yet they were being selfish and being unkind and hurting the vulnerable people. So we're tempted also in our times of trial to complain, to be angry, to be discouraged, to question, or to be passive, or to simply give in to our passions. The strong temptation to sin is often the Christian's greatest trial. We don't want to give in, and yet there is this strong desire to do so. So I pray that this message today and the message that is to follow after this one will help you if you are finding yourself in the strong grip of temptation. But the reality is that man is tempted, and the words trial and temptation do go together. Now, secondly, James is going to head off the typical response that we have when he begins verse 13 by saying, let no person say, when he is tempted, it's God who is tempting me. Now, James wouldn't have needed to say this if this was not a potential problem for the brothers there and a potential problem for us. Blaming others was then and is now our natural response to our personal sin dilemma. If you're a parent or you work with children, you know that a five-year-old, an eight-year-old child is really an aspiring solicitor, a good defense attorney. They're keen. Children are very keen at defending their actions by blaming other people to be at fault for those actions. But he hit me first. We have this notorious story in our family lore, our family history of the cousins and the candy quandary. Two cousins were caught eating candy together one time at a family gathering, and the father of the one child was talking to his son about the dangers of eating so much candy and was reprimanding him for that. And the child said, but my cousin was forcing me to eat this candy. Did you ever know of a child who had to be forced to eat candy? But far more significant than blaming other people for our sin is the temptation to blame God for our sin. Now, I don't know of any Christian who would take the advice of Job's wife to curse God and die. So we could quickly brush over the instruction that James has here for us in the first part of verse 13 and just move on to verse 13 and beyond and say, well, that doesn't really apply to me. I would never say I am tempted by God. I think it will help us to understand the importance of this warning as we understand the importance of one word. And that word is a preposition that we find in verse 13. Let no one say when he is tempted, I am tempted by God. Or in some of the other English versions, it's of God. But the word in Greek is the word apo, which means away from or at a distance. Now in verse 14, there's a similar phrase. Each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires and enticed. And we see the same preposition there, by, and that's often translated in other places of as well. That word there is different. That word there is hupo in Greek, which means close or nearby or under. So what's the importance of this? What's the significance of these little prepositions in these phrases? How could I best describe this to help us understand? Well, in the game of hurling, the bravest men on the field, yes, at that moment, I think the bravest men in the world are the goalkeepers. That dense little ball is moving around the field at speeds of 150 kilometers an hour, and maybe faster. So the statement could be, the goalkeeper was hit in the face by the ball. It was a direct contact. It was a direct hit. The ball hit the goalkeeper in the face. That could be hupo. The goalkeeper needed stitches. He broke his nose. There was blood. It was an active hit. It was a direct hit. There was an agent that did the hitting. It was the ball. And that would describe verse 14, when he is drawn away by his own desires and enticed. But we could also say this sentence, the goalkeeper was hit in the face by the player. And we could say that word by could be apo. Now the player was 25 meters away when he swung that hurley. He never touched the goalkeeper directly. But from a distance, he initiated a chain of events that propelled the ball through the air, with the result being a smashed face for the goalkeeper. Now, we would never say, God, you are directly provoking me into sinful behavior. We know better than to suggest that we are being tempted by God or hupo God, like God is nearby. God is the active agent in our temptation. God is the ball that smashed us in the face. But I wonder, how often do we entertain the idea that our temptation is by God, apo God, that God is the player that initiated the chain of events that ultimately led to my failure and my giving in to the temptation to sin. And ultimately, we assign responsibility for my sin upon He who was the one responsible for it in my mind, far away, though it wasn't close. For a biblical example, we would need to look no further than the first temptation, the first sin in Genesis 3. In Genesis 3, after man and woman had disobeyed God, and God asked them where they were, and man began to explain what he was doing and where he was and why he hid himself. And God asked some more questions. Man's response is very telling to God. Then the man said in verse 12 of Genesis 3, "The woman whom you gave to be with me, she gave me of the tree and I ate." Now, who taught Adam to talk like this? Who taught Adam how to blame? Adam was in the process of abdicating himself of the responsibility for his sin. And so he blamed Eve, but indirectly, he also blamed God. It was like he was saying Eve was the ball, the agent that hit me in the face, but God was the player out there in the field 25 meters away. God, you gave me this woman. Everything was just fine before she came into my life. So God, it's really your problem. This is why I did it. So what are some ways in which we could think like Adam, even if we wouldn't say these words? God, you called me into this particular work that is so demanding of my time and energy. And now my marriage is broken, and it's ultimately your responsibility. God, you created me like I am. Surely, God, you will consent to my sinful practices that I do when I'm just being me. God, you knew that all this was going to happen to me, yet you allowed it. You didn't stop it from happening. You could have done something, God. Why didn't you? So there it is. That's our tendency, to put a moral obligation upon God that does not belong on God. It belongs to us. And James's warning, I believe, cuts us off at the pass when we attempt to think or talk like this. And I think it's a very good thing indeed that James does this. Now, the next thing that James will do is tell us a very important fact about the nature of God. And this is number 3, God cannot be tempted by evil. The word I chose is untemptable. That word best describes these 3 words. God cannot be tempted means untemptable. Temptation proof. Temptation free. Just think about that for a moment. God cannot be tempted by evil. Isn't that amazing? Now, one lingering and persistent question in the world that man asks is, how can a good God allow all the evil that we see in the world? The skeptic asks this question to to deny the existence of God. Those who believe that God exists still ponder this question. The killing of the innocents, the plundering of the vulnerable, the raw wickedness, the debauchery, the evil. How can this go on and on and on like this? This statement by James is very instructive to help us understand this question. God is not tempted by evil. God is untemptable. Why is God not tempted by evil? There's an interesting description of God that Paul gives in 1 Timothy 1, verse 11, when he's talking about the glorious gospel of the blessed God. Here Paul describes God as the blessed God. Now this word blessed is the same word that Jesus uses in the Sermon on the Mount, in the Beatitudes, and it's the same word that James has used in verse 12 of the chapter that we're studying now. This word means supremely happy, completely satisfied. So a divine being who is supremely happy and completely satisfied cannot be induced or seduced to want anything else. He can't be tempted. Paul also, in his message to the people in Athens, talks about a God, the God that is not worshipped with man's hands as though he needed anything, since he gives to all life, breath, and all things. God does not need anything. You know, we'll see in our next message, and I read those verses already, verses 14 and following, that temptation to sin comes when we have the perception of a need that is unmet, a longing that we follow with our own selfish will to its ultimate and deadly end. Well, God cannot be tempted because God needs nothing more. God has perfect knowledge of that which is good. God has the perfect ability to possess that which is good. God has the perfect capacity to enjoy and be satisfied in that which is good. And that is why God will never be tempted to sin. It's not only that God cannot sin because he will not lower his standard of holiness. That is true. But God absolutely does not need to sin, because he already has everything he needs. And I want to remind you that the problem of evil in the world is not the beginning of the story. It's not the end of the story. The world, time, humanity, and evil are only a pinprick in the fabric of eternity. God existed, like Paul described in Timothy and in Acts, from eternity past. In this way, as the blessed God, the God who doesn't need anything, he was and is completely satisfied and needing nothing. And I believe that God will exist like this in eternity future, completely satisfied and needing nothing. But he has chosen to share that eternity future with the created image bearers that he has redeemed, men and women. I observed a couple years ago to my wife that I've now lived more years of my life with her than without her. And I wonder, at what point in eternity will God say, I have now been with humans longer than I have been without them? You know, that's an incomprehensible question, because God is eternal. God, supremely happy, completely satisfied, in need of nothing, self-existent, yet he chose to create us for his glory. And he invites us to share eternity with him. Now, fourthly, God never tempts anyone to do evil. There are two reasons that a person might tempt another to do evil. One of them is for that person to enjoy a sinful experience together. In Proverbs 1, in the section verses 10 through 19, the writer of that proverb talks about this temptation of a crowd of foolish ones, of sinful ones, inviting another one to join them and saying this, "Come with us, let us lie in wait to shed blood. Let us lurk secretly for the innocent without cause. Let us swallow them alive like Sheol and whole like those who go down to the pit. We shall find all kinds of precious possessions. We shall fill our house with spoil. Cast in your lot among us. Let us all have one purse." There's a series of enticements to join in a temptation together. We've already shown, I believe, that God has no desire, no purpose to tempt one of his image bearers into sinning together with him or with others. The second reason that someone might tempt another person to do evil would be because that person is evil. You know, there are depraved people who get some sadistic pleasure out of watching, out of orchestrating, out of organizing evil. So just for us to suggest that God would take pleasure in watching, in organizing, in arranging evil would be blasphemous. That's not God. It would be like thinking of God as the little boy who rips the wings off of houseflies in order to have sport. And that's not the God of the universe. That's not the God of the Bible. So my friends, this should be reassuring to you who in a moment of trial ask the question, in a time of trial, ask the question, God, where are you? Not only will God never, ever, ever tempt you to do evil, but God is actively working in your behalf to help you overcome your temptations to do evil. I want to close with a few verses. Romans 12:21 instructs us, "Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good." 1 Corinthians 10:13 says, "No temptation has overtaken you except such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but will with the temptation also make a way of escape that you may be able to bear it." God is on your side. God will help you. And then the beautiful verses in Hebrews chapter 4, verse 14. "Seeing then that we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weakness, but was in all points tempted as we are, yet without sin." Though God is not tempted by evil, yet when God became flesh, Jesus encountered temptations. We can read about them in Matthew 4, in Matthew 26. But I believe that Hebrews 4:15 is true, and that Jesus was in all points tempted as we are. So Jesus was tempted in many, many other ways. And I think James, as the brother of Jesus, had a very good opportunity. He had a window as he observed his brother facing temptations. And I can believe James when he says, God cannot be tempted to sin. James experienced that in the first person. And so James would have us follow the words of Hebrews 4, verse 16. Let us therefore come boldly to the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need. So instead of brazenly accusing God of tempting us, let's come boldly to God's throne of grace. Instead of harboring a question about where God is in the midst of my trial, let's come boldly and find mercy and the help we need in that moment of trial at the throne of grace. You may trust, you can trust in the untemptable, temptation-proof, temptation-free God.
If thou